Welcome to The Babblery, conversations where we explore the knowledge, opinions, passions, and obsessions of my guests. This is Suki Wessling, and today's program was recorded for Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM, Santa Cruz, California. You can listen online at www.ksqd.org. Welcome to Talk of the Bay, KSQD's local news program brought to you every weekday at 5 p.m. I'm your host, Suki Wessling, and today I am excited to feature an organization that had a direct effect on my own life a number of years ago and has had an amazing impact on our coastal environment since 1918. Save the Redwoods League is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to protect and restore California redwoods and connect people to the peace and beauty of redwood forests. The League protects redwoods by purchasing redwood forests and the surrounding land needed to nurture them. I am joined today by two representatives from Save the Redwoods. Dr. Joanna Nelson is the League's Director of Science and Conservation Planning. Welcome, Joanna.
Thank you so much. So wonderful to be here, Suki.
And Anthony Castaños is the League's Land Stewardship Manager. Welcome, Anthony. I wanted to start with a little story to illustrate part of what Save the Redwoods does. I know that reading about how an organization saved a group of trees from harvest or a piece of land from development can seem a bit abstract, but this story happens in a place most local residents have visited. In 1996, my husband and I were looking for a new house and came upon one on the edge of Nicene Marks State Park. The realtor excitedly told us that the land behind our house had been purchased to be added to Nicene Marks, but when we looked at county records, it was slated for development. We called up the organization we were told had bought it, Save the Redwoods, and indeed, the League had saved this piece of land from development. Any listeners who have walked the old growth loop in Nicene Marks can truly visualize the gift that we were all given by your organization. It's almost impossible to imagine McMansions lining that steep ravine and the amount of trees they would have had to cut even to bring a road in. So I wanted to start this conversation by saying thank you.
Thank you so much, Suki. It's wonderful to hear your experience of the benefit of being in the Redwoods.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's just so important for all of us to realize how much work is being done behind the scenes. And I hope that this hour we can get a little bit of a feeling for what you do and what sort of support you can use. So, Anthony, are you on now?
How's the audio now?
There you are.
Excellent.
Hello, Anthony, League's Land Stewardship Manager.
Thank you for having us, Suki. I appreciate it. Sorry for the technical difficulties.
That is part of live radio. We just roll with it. So, Save the Redwoods uses a number of methods to save redwoods, not just buying land. So I wondered if we could start with a description of what you do, and then we'll focus on an ongoing project that you're working on, San Vicente Redwoods. Joanna, you want to take that one?
Sure, and I'll hand it pretty quickly to Anthony for all his good work on the ground. So just as you mentioned, the League has a number of methods to save lands and make sure they're stewarded. One is purchasing land outright in title and then having a plan to turn that over, for example, to public lands so that everybody in California can enjoy it. There's also a tool of conservation easements. And if we imagine a bundle of rights associated with land, it's purchasing some part of those rights, usually the right to develop. The League recently made a purchase of land in Mendocino County and was able to participate in turning that over to the tribal and indigenous people whose traditional territory that was. And that is called Fish Run Place. We got a lot of wonderful feedback when that media went out. And so in the Sinkyo language, that's Si'i Le Dun. and that is now owned and stewarded by the Intertribal Sinkyone Wilderness Council. So there are many ways in which we participate in a process of protecting land and in which we consider land protected. And like I said, I'd love to hand it over to you, Anthony, for more on than what we do on the ground.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Joanna, for that introduction. And it's a real thrill just where we're at with Save the Redwoods League. So often our job, our role for the first 90 years, I should say, was to buy and transfer land to different agencies. And really, there's just great opportunities to protect these lands, but we're learning that it really requires ongoing stewardship and management, and we want to coexist with these natural spaces. Obviously, this is a really beautiful state. I was born and raised in California, love it dearly. I want to see it well cared for. So any work that we can do to steward these lands, restore areas that might have been damaged over the years is the focal point of my job. So much of it is really just trying to get ready for future wildfires, bringing fire back to this land that was used by the natives for thousands of years, and just the opportunity to really re-implement those practices, work with local tribes, work with different organizations and agencies. There's just so much opportunity, so many people that really want to be a part of this work. And I think I'm really hopeful for the future as far as the work that we can do together.
So you mentioned restoring damaged lands. You know, I guess most people think of, you know, when they think of redwoods, they think of these parks, some of which are old growth and were protected pretty early, and others like Nicene Marks are second growth. But they don't think necessarily of damage. So what kind of damage are you talking about?
Absolutely. There's any range. But in many ways, when settlers first came out this way, and they saw these old growth forests and probably viewed them as 2x4s, quite frankly, and it's a great opportunity to build houses, establish towns, and get settled. And the impacts of all that logging, which were before the forest practice rules in California, were before we knew anything about the wildlife, before we really knew anything about the management of what was required to coexist here, had a lot of really serious impacts to the land that over the last two centuries, we're really starting to see the consequences of this at full front. And you add climate change to that equation, and that's why we're having some of the worst wildfires we've ever encountered in these last few years. So really want to be cognizant of that and see how we can get back to stewarding these lands effectively so that we don't experience these catastrophic wildfires year after year and can live in a more functional way among this beautiful state.
Yeah, so when you talk about a piece of land that perhaps hasn't been public, but now you're buying it or entering into some sort of rights agreement. What sort of jobs do you have to try to turn around the damage?
In large part, when many of these forests haven't been cared for, even if they were clear cut at some point or just haven't been stewarded, what we see is this really dense accumulation of fuels. A lot of understory brush, small trees, dense forests where in the past you could see into the forest because it regularly encountered fire either through the natives or through lightning strikes over the years. And with the fire suppression that we've implemented in these last 200 years, the forests are very congested. And when a fire does come through, it's not if, it's when. All this fuel, literal tinder, of the duff on the ground and these low-level vegetation adds a much greater intensity to the fire, which is not natural. Usually fires prior to Western settlement were a slow trickle along the ground, would burn up fuels along the base, and were very functional to the health of the forest. But now we see fires burning into the canopies, completely devastating forests, and leaving only, you know, black charred trees afterwards. It's very unnatural and certainly something we want to address.
Okay. Yeah, before the show, I w had been looking at a project that I know you both want to talk about, the San Vicente Ra Redwoods project, and which is up on Empire Grade. And I will link to this on the podcast page for the show. There is a video that I was just going to sort of glance at, and then I ended up watching the whole thing because it was really interesting about an old dam that's on that property and what they're doing there to get rid of the dam and tr what they're hoping to restore there. So maybe we should move to the San Vicente project. Can you describe what that is? How it came about?
Absolutely. The San Vicente Redwoods property is 8,532 acres, so it's a pretty good chunk of land. It was purchased by Semper Environs Fund and Peninsula Open Space Trust in 2012, and then Save the Redwoods League purchased a conservation easement in 2014. And we've been working also with the Land Trust of Santa Cruz County, which is managing the public access piece. So it's four organizations involved in the management of this property. And I always like to say if there's a restoration or a stewardship project happening somewhere, it's also happening at San Vicente Redwoods. There's so many different projects going on, so many different partners involved. We're able to get so much work done together. It's really just been the highlight of my career so far, just how much we're able to accomplish and how well all these different organizations work together. Certainly, there's always different projects to navigate and priorities to sort out. And I just really feel fortunate that we can do so much with all these different groups and really maximize the efforts involved, such as the dam removal that you mentioned.
Yeah, and so what was this land before? What was it being used for?
It was actually owned by a cement company, Cemex, and there's a pretty sizable quarry on the property that was used to help rebuild so much of the Bay Area after the past major earthquakes, both in 1906 and 1989. And well, actually, no, it wasn't used in the 89 earthquake, but after the 1906 earthquake. And the cement company hasn't been operating it, hadn't been operating the quarry in the last few decades, but still logged. So the intent was to protect this land, still perform sustainable harvest on the property in a way that we recognize is needed. Obviously, we like to live in structures and live in homes, and that requires wood. So we're cognizant of that. We want to make sure that if that is done, it's done in a sustainable way. And then also looking at areas of the property where we focus on restoration work, stewarding the land, and getting creative with ways that we can best serve the forest.
And it sounded like what you said before sort of dovetails with the what you were just saying about sustainably harvesting trees, that you were saying that one of the problems that we had was not weeding out the forest, not getting things out. So is this going to help as far as keeping the understory more open and the trees more able to grow larger and stronger?
Absolutely. It really does take active management, both with lands that are used for timber harvest, but also lands that we intend to restore. So even with the areas of the forest that we use to cut trees for sale, we're still actively stewarding the land, thinking of ways that we can best manage it, creating fuel breaks, removing invasives, restoring the creeks, removing old dams. There's just so many different opportunities that we can pursue, and I'm certainly always seeking grant money to help fund these projects because they're expensive but very fruitful.
Well, you just said, you were saying that, and my mind immediately went to the fact that there is a down tree on a trail that I walk regularly that is just I can't remember. I think it's a tan oak. It was large, and it's just sitting there with its dry, brittle leaves just sitting there. And I realize that the state parks are have funding issues, but I just look at that and think, oh, well, that's a perfect way for a forest fire to find a really hospitable place to burn, because it hasn't been, it just fell and it's just been sitting there for a couple of years now.
Yeah, that's certainly a great example of just the amount of work it requires to steward these lands. And Save the Redwoods really makes an effort to work with our agencies as well, because we recognize there's a lot of protected public land out there, It just takes so many hands to take care of it. And I think it's clear that many of our friends in different agencies hopefully appreciate our support as we try to take care of these lands together, because the amount of staff that they have just isn't enough to really care for all the land that requires so much time.
Yeah, I mean, and I haven't even gotten to when you were talking about invasive species and what I see out there. It's really incredible. I mean, the at this point, the un, in parts of Nisene Marks, the understory is completely covered with ivy, which is not native, and does like to climb up trees and strangle them. So.
It does. Yes, English ivy is the bane of my existence, but
Yeah, so how do you get it out? I mean, do you just yank it out by the roots, but it'll come back, right?
it's it definitely, for a lot of these invasives, we sort of have to pick and choose our battles. A great deal of it largely requires just trying to keep it contained, quite frankly, because they're so good at spreading that it's very difficult to eradicate it. Certainly, we continue to put in the effort to do so. We're lucky to have a lot of different volunteers in the Santa Cruz region that come out and support those efforts, because it does require a lot of hands and a lot of time. But yeah, certainly, it's an effort, an ongoing effort, where we need to make sure that we allocate the time to it each year, because if you skip one year, they can just come right back, which unfortunately happened during the peak of COVID. So we're playing catch up now.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You never know how the, unintended and unexpected consequences of things like asking people to stay home for a few months, and especially with, I guess it was spring, so that would be the time to pull up all these weeds.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, we just have a couple more minutes before the break. Can you describe a little bit? I want to, after the break, let's get to the collaboration with the Native Stewardship Corps, but just for a couple minutes, talk about what's happening in San Vicente Redwoods. So you mentioned, or Joanna mentioned, the conservation easement. What is a conservation easement? How does that work?
Yeah, Joanna made a great analogy that we like to use, as far as if you think of the ownership of a property as a kind of a bundle of sticks of all the different rights and opportunities you have. An easement, you work it out with the landowner, and we can say, well, we'd like this one stick that's for timber rights, or we'd like this other stick that's for road access, and all these different easements and opportunities to work on a site is usually what we focus on at Sea of the Redwoods. And we have 35 different conservation easements across 39,000 acres throughout the Redwood region. And they all vary in scope and size and opportunities. San Vicente is certainly our most robust, because it really came with the lens of, well, how do we want to steward these lands? It's not just about protecting the trees and saying, okay, we're done. How do we actively protect? And so the easements give us an opportunity to work with landowners. In this case, there are two other land trusts who are more engaged in this kind of work. But sometimes landowners, they can't get their boots on the ground, don't have the resources. And so in many ways, it gives us the opportunity to do that and work with these different landowners and think of ways that we can restore and steward the land together, while they still get to enjoy these beautiful spaces that they grew up on or cared for and stewarded over the years as best they could on their own.
So you also do this with privately owned property?
Correct. Yes, that
Oh,
is usually
interesting.
the norm.
So will you come and work on my backyard?
I'll
Just
bring my
kidding.
chainsaw and here we go.
Yeah. Now we have a little tiny piece of redwoods. We do pretty well. But I can imagine just with that how much work it is. I'm going to take a short break here, and we will be right back with more Talk of the Bay and Save the Redwoods. I am speaking with Dr. Joanna Nelson and Anthony Castaños from the Save the Redwoods League. And we've been talking a little bit about an ongoing project that they're working on in the San Vicente Redwoods. And I wanted to move to, this is such an interesting thing that I hadn't, I mean, I was vaguely aware of, but watching the video that I will link to on the podcast page, I was really struck by how much work is being done directly with the original native peoples of this area, the Amamutsun Land Trust and their Native Stewardship Corps. And so I wanted to move to that and ask you, I guess, a few questions about how that works, why you're doing this. This isn't the sort of thing that organizations like yours did in the past. What is the process and what's the hoped for outcome of this?
Thanks, Suki. I think I'll start with that and then, you know, certainly hand it to Anthony. And Anthony was my introduction to this project in San Vicente. So I want to start and say that this land in Santa Cruz, particularly from the Pajaro River in Watsonville south to almost the Monterey Peninsula, is the traditional territory of the Amamutsun Tribal Band. And then right here in Santa Cruz, where I am, like you, I live here, this is the unceded land of the Owaswa-speaking Yupi people, where the closest living descendants of the mission program in Santa Cruz and San Juan Bautista are the Amamutsun Tribal Band. And so they're doing the work. And sometimes we know that we're on the traditional territory of indigenous people who are no longer due to genocide. And it's up to the surrounding tribal and indigenous groups to decide, you know, who's stewarding which land or what they're doing collaboratively. So that's backing up. And I'm non-Indigenous, so I'm not speaking for Indigenous people. I'm saying what I've learned as a collaborator. And the work in San Vicente, there's been different aspects, but one project was fuel reduction and then burning piles, which is using chainsaws, which are a good tool for taking care of forests.
Not traditional tool, I just wanted
yeah,
to.
Yeah, not traditional, but a thoughtful tool of, yes, we're going to take down the smaller trees or the thicket of trees so the large mature trees have more room so that we've reduced the risk of wildfire. And then piling those fuels, you know, into piles, and there's extra care. There isn't just bake a heap and set it on fire. Right. There are rules about how big is your burn pile, how far do you clear around each one to mineral soil so that it won't burn. And the work with the Native Stewardship Corps of the Amamutsun Land Trust was getting out on the land to do this work. And as an outgrowth of it, having their first formal collaboration with CAL FIRE in doing those burns. And that happened the week before everybody went into shutdown for COVID. So it was something like the week of March 13th in 2020. There has been further restoration work after CZU, and I'll hand it off to Anthony to tell us about that.
Yes, we've been working with the Amamutsun Land Trust. It's just been a terrific effort. I think in many ways, just makes me so hopeful for the future as we continue to work with different tribes on properties we own across the state, because they just bring so much knowledge and history that we has either been lost or ignored intentionally or otherwise, and trying to reincorporate that just serves our mission in so many ways. And I'm really grateful for all the different members of these tribes for their willingness to work with us, given the history of persecution that they face for trying to convince us what they already knew of as far as what these lands needed. So where do we go here with San Vicente? Really in line with what I was mentioning earlier as far as trying to thin out these dense stands so that they're less prone to intense wildfire, high intensity wildfire. in February of 2020, we worked with CAL FIRE and the Alamosa Land Trust and different partners working at San Vicente to do a prescribed burn along a major thoroughfare right adjacent along the boundary line of the property. And it's really striking walking the boundary line of that prescribed burn unit now, because mm-hmm. you look to the left of the forest that wasn't treated and you see completely burned trees, head to toe, completely charred. And then you look to the right in the unit that was treated with prescribed fire just to, 6 months before the wildfire came through, and it looks great. The trees have green canopies. It looks like a really healthy forest. And that
interesting.
And I'm talking about a 3 foot wide break line for the prescribed burn. Left, everything's completely burned head to toe. Right, everything looks great. It really is striking what these prescribed burns can do to dramatically reduce the intensity of these fires. And on the other side of that major thoroughfare, Empire Grade, is a community of homes. And fortunately, the drop in intensity of that wildfire helped to protect their homes as well as keeping the forest, that section of forest, in good shape. So really gives credence to this work. And while it is a Herculean effort to try and advance more prescribed burning, it's so critical because it's so easy to see the payoff of this work. And just if we can really get more of it done, I think we'd be in much better shape in the future for wildfires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, something that has been done around the world in the past. And then we seem to get this mania for save every little plant that might grow on public lands. And that obviously was not really a good point of view, although it seems, I guess at first when people first heard about it, it seemed a little bit illogical. Why would we burn down a forest, mm-hmm. And it seems like it's well, at least this year, it's been even harder to do, because I know we had one prescribed burn that jumped a little out of control, because it was drier than they expected. It was in the middle of the winter. How long is the process to designate an area, plan, and then actually do it if the conditions are right?
That's a great question. And it's certainly something we want to make clear to people, that while these lands do need to burn, fire is inherently risky. There's no mm-hmm. amount of prescribed burning we can do that is completely risk-free, unfortunately. So we have to be cognizant of that. And we really do a great amount of due diligence in order to make sure that while there are risks involved, we are demonstrating the most careful planning, making sure the prescriptions are in line for an effective prescribed burn. We're talking about humidity, temperature, wind, topography, all these different factors, mm-hmm. so that we plan out these burns really well. We work with people who are certified as quote-unquote burn bosses, which sort of sounds like a funny name, but is actually what they're called.
That's quite a job. Can you imagine having a card? You're a burn boss.
It does sound pretty cool. I'm a little jealous, to be honest. Maybe someday. But some of these folks that we work with have just been doing prescribed burning for decades, that have seen so many different types of burns, really bring so much knowledge to it. And you couple that with working with the local tribes, and it really sets us up for a great foundation for doing this work really effectively. So we are very cognizant of the risks involved, but are doing everything we can to mitigate and make sure they're as few and unlikely as possible.
Uh-huh. I wanted to ask, and I don't know if either of you would be able to answer this, but I know that the little bit I learned from the video I watched was this is a two-way educational street, that there are young people of Native American ancestry who haven't grown up with a lot of knowledge about the area that they live in, the natural knowledge that was lost. And how does it work to send that education in the other direction as well? I know you have a Native Stewardship Corps. Do you reach out to people who don't have this knowledge to welcome them in and foster it?
I think one way that I'd answer that question is that it's it's up to the tribes and Indigenous communities to say what the education is. And the tribal chairman of the Amamutsun, Valentin Lopez, you know, I've heard him use the word relearning. Mm-hmm. We're relearning our traditional knowledge because we were violently interrupted in it. And so again, that's up to them. So we could have a collaboration across Western science, which is, you know, one way of talking about university science and training, and Indigenous science, and the teaching would be within Indigenous communities. That's certainly something where we see good collaborations and we want to be part of those good collaborations. And just to add to what Anthony said in terms of preparing for prescribed fire, it might be 3 years of reducing fuels before you're ready to do what's called broadcast burning, which is setting fire on the ground that might travel, mm-hmm. right? You've reduced those fuels. You've done what's called scraping line. You've made a control line around the area that you intend to burn that, again, is scraped down to mineral soil where you don't have anything flammable. And you've brought in a burn boss through, again, an agency certification program like the National Wildfire Coordinating Group, or you're respecting the cultural lineage of Indigenous burners who are, again, coming from 10,000, 20,000 years of knowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it sounds like quite a process. So let me ask you about the San Vicente Redwoods. Will this eventually be open to the public, and in what capacity and when?
Yes, great question. As I mentioned, the Land Trust of Santa Cruz County is leading the public access component of the San Vicente property, and we're hoping to open trails later this year on the main piece. So definitely look for that, and please do hike the trail, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I have hiking around. It really is a beautiful property, and even post-fire, really helps tell the story of the work that we've done in certain areas and the work to do ahead. So really excited for the public to come out. I know it adds some extra components as far as coordinating logistics. We still want to make sure mm-hmm. we do restoration work and other projects, but we really see it as an education piece. We don't want to do any of this work behind closed doors. We want the public to see it and ask questions, and gives us a chance to promote the work. So mm-hmm. really are excited. As far as the scope of the trail, be at the first phase, we're going to phase these different projects, but the first phase will be, I believe, 5 or 6 miles of trail, and then that'll be open eventually to equestrian and mountain biking as well as foot traffic. So we really want to see this as an opportunity to serve all different types of recreational opportunities as well.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I just wanted to add appreciation. You know, it takes so many partners. Appreciation to the Land Trust of Santa Cruz County, who's doing, again, leading this trail planning and implementation, and has also needed to pivot post-fire. So after CZU fire, reassessing, you know, where the public can go and making sure that trail access is safe. So of the many groups who are adapting after CZU, they're definitely doing that in establishing public access.
Uh-huh. That sounds great. And it's mostly second growth, right? Are there any old growth trees in there?
There are a few relic old growth trees, but for the most part, mm-hmm. the whole property has been cut over.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, second growth can be beautiful as well, and wonderful to be in. So that sounds great. We've been mentioning the CZU fire a little bit, and I wanted to address that from a few different perspectives. The first one, I guess, is, you know, you mentioned climate change, and fire is obviously fire. Our lands that are overloaded with fuel, and the fact that it's been drier, and we don't know when this dry period will end. Fingers crossed, it'll be this year. But what else about, you know, when you, if you address a single redwood tree and how it lives. What is that tree facing? What sort of future are we is the tree facing with climate change? What are some of the dangers? What are some of the ways in which it's resilient and you're hopeful?
Yeah, if we're thinking about an individual tree, and certainly in a landscape of forests, we're living in a hotter, drier world. So land and air is warming and drying. So there can be drought stress, even for trees that live in marine fog belt and are great at intercepting fog and that condensing fog dripping down on the ground, right? So we think of, oh, red coast redwoods will be okay. We don't really get massive wildfire through them. And of course, all of us in Santa Cruz County have had a different and startling experience of, yes, we do get fire ripping through coast redwood. So these trees are dealing with drought stress, and at times like now, and it depends on where they are in the range. So coast redwoods grow from Big Sur all the way up to the California-Oregon border, so a little bit up into southern Oregon. And so the trees from the north coast on upward, let's say Humboldt, Arcata area, are not as stressed. And the trees at the very southern edge and say the eastern edge are going through some more, have a drier environment. And so we look at, again, individual tree health. We look at dynamics of how mature forests help regulate water flow in our streams, because mature soils infiltrate water in good ways, act as a sponge and help us with regular water throughout the year. So we're looking at interconnected systems, again, of forests and water, and just like so many people, doing everything that we can for climate solutions so that we live in the we want to live in.
So is there any expectation that the it sounds like it's pretty clear that unless this warming and drying stops, that the habitat area in the south might become inhospitable to them. What about increasing up to the north? I just read about an education project for foresters in various parts of the country to learn about plants that they could start nurturing now that will do better, that are from more southern climates. Is this something that we might see with redwoods, that they might move up into Oregon?
That's something that we can generally expect for organisms, including coast redwoods. So, as a very general, in the northern hemisphere, we'd expect species to move upslope, up in elevation, and further north. And something interesting is this idea of novel ecosystems that, of course, instead of everything, instead of coast redwood and tan oak and bay laurel, all the things you expect to see together on your hike, instead of them moving together en suite, that there's going to be some disaggregation of which species are living with which other species and which species are more mobile. So again, this introduction of more uncertainty is something that we will both live with, and something where our efforts all the time on climate solutions matter.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 Santa Cruz, and we'll be back to talk more with Save the Redwoods League. I am back, Talk of the Bay, with Save the Redwoods, Joanna Nelson and Anthony Castaños. And I want to, talk a little bit about the CZU fire and aftermath. There has been an ongoing effort by the community to support the people who were victims in a variety of ways, lost their homes, had to leave their homes. And along with this, hand in hand with this, is the loss of the landscape that they lived in. And I know, Anthony, your description of the prescribed burn area and how much healthier it looks after the fire moved through was really interesting for me. My first question is, what can they expect after, say this is a property that had been heavily wooded and the fire came through? What sort of recovery do we see, and how do people who are trying to be stewards of the land, how would they help that recovery along on their own property?
It's a great question, really, because we're experiencing wildfires at an intensity that we just haven't seen before or don't have on record. So a big part of our work is to try and glean as many lessons as possible. We install data collection plots where we measure the trees and all these different factors to absorb as much data as we can and look at it over the years and see how the forest responds. But ultimately, we're still moving forward with a lot of the efforts that we know are needed to address the risk of wildfires, such as restoration thinning and more prescribed burning. Ultimately, it's the scale. Really just need to be doing more of it. And if everyone had a drip torch and a chainsaw in their closet, that would be a big help. Obviously, we want people to do this smart and effectively, but I really see in the future that we'll all be land stewards, and it's really going to require everyone to be involved because of just the scale of work required. And I think it's really possible. I know that the UC Cooperative Extension has championed this effort to organize what we're calling prescribed burn associations across the state, where local landowners collaborate together to do prescribed burning on each other's lands. So that way they can share tools, they can provide each other just the presence of another person to help manage a prescribed burn or a restoration project. And it gives sort of more power to the people in a way that we can all steward our lands together, largely because CAL FIRE is doing everything it can, but is very short-staffed compared to the scale of work that's needed. So we certainly appreciate the efforts of our friends and these different agencies, but recognize that it really does require a lot of effort from everyone as a whole.
I will also put a link on the podcast page to the Firewise neighborhood project that my neighborhood took part in, and it's just fabulous and virtually free, and it's all about neighbors getting together and learning how they can protect their own neighborhoods better. And I'll tell you, it also fostered a lot of community and togetherness in our neighborhood. So I highly recommend it. I did a program on that last year. So say someone has property that has not burned. So let's talk about, the majority of people who live in private homes in Santa Cruz County that are wooded, are living on land that has not necessarily been maintained properly. What would you say to individual homeowners about how they can become better stewards of the land, both for the land's sake and also what they can do to make their property more de defensible?
That's a great question. There's a number of different workshops and even agencies that can give guidance and feedback to different landowners. I know the Resource Conservation District has a variety of staff to help advise local landowners and give them tips on the best way to create defensible spaces for their homes. But it really varies case by case. Every property is really different, but there are a lot of resources and even grant money available to local landowners to help manage some of these costs, because it can be expensive to work with professional foresters and sawyer crews if you don't want to do all the backbreaking work yourself, because it can be very strenuous.
Yes,
But
indeed.
and I just want to, support what you said, Suki, about Firewise communities and their fire safe councils. So Bonnie Doon Fire Safe Council is one that I know of, right? So those are, I know you're talking about what could an individual homeowner do. And again, so I've worked with homeowners association members who say, we're going to do this together. We're going to look for grants together. And what Anthony said about prescribed burn associations, so that's a forum for skill building and skill sharing, as well as doing the work, so that again, that the work is done safely, the work is done with skill. So right back to, yes, homeowners can read online about defensible space and what that entails. And if they're looking at, wow, that sounds expensive, at what kind of community mutual aid we can give each other in getting ready.
So one of the things the one of the you have three pillars of what you do as an organization, the Save the Redwoods League, and one that we haven't talked about is connect. How do you work to connect people with our forests and make them help them feel like this is part of that they are part of saving and maintaining our forests?
Yeah, I'd like to really appreciate the team within Save the Redwoods League who works on parks and public engagement. And again, not only their focus on sharing the experience of the beauty and awe of the Redwood Forest, but really facing the truth of historic and current barriers to certain marginalized groups on accessing nature, parks, and Redwood forests. So, some things I can think of, and I'd love to hear more from Anthony, are there's a wonderful podcast called I'll Go If You Go from Save the Redwoods League about adventures in the Redwoods. We maintain lists of communities through our website and ways to get in touch and be involved. And there are specific outreach programs to elementary school students, for example, or communities in different areas of Redwood Forest regions that are have not been reached out to generally.
Absolutely. Joanna summed it up really well. I think it can be very easy to dismiss a problem or just put it out of mind if you have no connection to it. And if we really want to elevate our work, creating those kind of connection pieces is really critical so that people can experience the Redwood Forest, really glean just the magic of it all, and help support our work. And the more that we can do that and give people opportunities to enjoy these spaces, in a safe way that keeps the forest in good shape as well is really important. And we often, when we're acquiring new lands, we bring the lens of, well, how can we create some kind of trail here so that people can enjoy it and connect to these lands? So I'm always in awe of the amount of work that our marketing team is able to do to promote these projects and our connect team to really make it happen. And it's just such a thrill seeing these projects go underway and getting to be a part of it via Save the Redwoods.
Yeah,
And I'll
and
add,
oh, go
if
ahead.
I may. So a very concrete is our website is savetheredwoods.org. Save the Redwoods is all one word, .org. And if you enter in the search box community or communities, I tried them both and got good different things. That's a good way to find out what's happening with outreach and what you can get involved with.
Okay, so do you do have things that volunteers can do, able-bodied volunteers can come in and help work?
We do have opportunities at San Vicente Redwoods for invasive removal. I know that different organizations are managing the volunteer opportunities, but if, certainly if folks are interested, I can direct them into that direction if they contact us on our website.
Okay. That sounds great. And are there, well, I guess I'll leave that to connecting on the website, but just thinking about if people are now feeling all stoked to go out and help, where they would go to find that information. But I will definitely put information about that on our podcast page. And I wanted to ask you if there's anything else about the Redwoods and the organization briefly that I didn't ask about that you really think that listeners should know.
I'll add one more thing to your question before that. So, if people are all stoked to come help, and I'll spell this, one place you could go is the Amamutsun Land Trust website, because they have a native plants planting project just south of Pescadero, for example, near Pie Ranch. So, I'll spell it amamutsunlandtrust.org is AMAHMUTSUN. LANDTRUST.org. Is there anything we didn't ask you or you didn't ask us? Sorry, other way around.
That's okay. You can ask me what you want.
I think just a thread that we've been talking about is that we have a lot of power together in our communities and our multiple communities to find out what's happening with forests and climate change, with forests and people, and to pitch in the different ways that we can. And whatever our skills are, there's a place for us to pitch in.
All right.
Anthony, I wonder if you have anything else.
Well, we're sort of running out of time, and I had one last quick question.
Always, always go ahead.
We never have an, you always think an hour is long till you actually do an hour, and it's like, wait, where'd that go? So I wanted to thank you, Joanna Nelson and Anthony Castaños of Save the Redwoods League, for joining me today. And so I watched that video that I mentioned earlier that will be linked on the podcast page, and there was a quote that I just absolutely loved from one of the people in the video, and he said, "One thing we always miss when we talk about science is magic." So, one quick thing, 30 seconds each. If you could recommend only one magical spot on public redwood lands for our listeners to visit, what would it be and what makes it magical? Anthony, why don't you start us off?
I often think of Redwood, Prairie Creek Redwood State Park up in Humboldt County, where I first hiked around with our CEO when he was in his first month, and the winds were just right, and you could hear the trees, these old growth 2,000-year-old trees, swaying in the wind and making this beautiful symphony of moaning and groaning as they swayed in the wind. I never heard anything like it since, and every time I go back there, I get a glimpse of it, but it really was just the most magical thing I'd ever encountered in the Redwood Forest, and think of it very fondly.
That's beautiful, beautiful image. And Joanna, what's your magical spot?
Well, I will give a plus one to Anthony's Prairie Creek Redwoods State Park, and then I'll give us a local magic spot, which is Gray Whale Ranch up Empire Grade, which is the top of Wilder Ranch State Park, and recently had the chance to walk through there with my sweetheart in the evening, and just the red madrone lit up, and the redwood trees and the bird song was magical. That was really consistently going on. So, lots of
Lovely.
wonderful places.
You've been listening to The Babblery. Please visit www.babblery.com for links and information related to this podcast.